slide here. It says, what are the four types of markets? And it's got perfect competition, monopoly, monopolistic competition, and oligopoly. So what we did in the last chapter is that we covered perfect competition, and we did what with perfect competition? We asked a question. Now, what was that question we asked in perfect competition? I mean, what's our goal here? Our goal here is to maximize our profits. Now, how do we maximize our profits, or at least minimize our losses? What is it we have to know? Well, what is that answer, though? What does the MRM equal MC rule tell us? Well, yeah, it tells us how many units we should produce to either maximize a profit or minimize our losses. In this chapter, we're going to ask another question, and that is, what price are we going to charge to maximize the profit or minimize our losses? Now, why didn't we ask this question in perfect competition? Because in a perfectly competitive market, we were price takers rather than price makers. See, what determined our price in a perfectly competitive market? The market. And what is the market? Demand and supply. So we didn't have to ask the question, what price should we charge? Because we simply charge the market price. But now, in monopoly, that's not the case. In monopoly, we're going to find out that we are price makers rather than price takers. So now, when we're pretending that we own a monopoly-type business, the first question is, what price are we going to charge to maximize our profit or minimize our losses? And then the second question will be, how many units are we going to produce to maximize our profit or minimize our losses? Now, what is the answer to both those questions?
MR equals MC.
MR. Now, he just came in, didn't even know what I was talking about before, and he's got the answer. MR equals MC. That's always the answer to what price, what quantity. That's true for perfect competition, it's true for monopoly. But before we get into the mechanics of MR equals MC and determining what price and determining what quantity, we're going to first look at the characteristics. I mean, what is this market that we're talking about? Because there are these four type markets. Now, we've already defined what a perfectly competitive market is. That was a market where we had many, many buyers and many, many sellers, and that we could not differentiate our product from everyone else's, and therefore we had to sell at the market price. But if we did sell at the market price, then we could sell everything that we bring to market. And monopoly is quite different. In fact, monopoly is really the opposite extreme. Now, we're going to talk about the characteristics of a monopoly. But in between these two extremes, we've got other type markets. One is called monopolistic competition and oligopoly. So in the next chapter, we're going to look at monopolistic competition. And then lastly, we're going to look at the characteristics of an oligopoly. Now, every business will fall into one of these four categories. Asking the same question, that is, what price we're going to charge, how many units we're going to produce, what will our profits be at point of profit maximization, or what will our losses be at the point of loss minimization. If we're making a loss, should we stay open or should we close down? Because all of this is, what kind of analysis? I mean, we're going to look at these four type markets, but always what type time frame are we talking about?
Short run.
Yeah, short term or short run, where we cannot change our plant capacity. Let's look at some of the characteristics of a monopoly and see how it differs from perfect competition. A monopoly is when you only have a seller of a good or service with no close substitutes. When we talk about a monopoly, we're not talking about a company that is the sole seller in the whole world. Because we can have a monopoly in a certain area, even a small area. No matter where you live, how many choices do you have when you want to buy energy, like electricity?
One.
So whatever company you buy from, that company is a monopoly in the area that you live in. Now, we call that a natural monopoly, and we're going to find out how come that is. I mean, how come it is that we don't have more choices. But the point I'm making is that you can have a monopoly in a certain area. It doesn't have to be worldwide or even nationwide or even statewide. What we're saying here is that we have a monopoly, and for all practical purposes, whatever this monopoly is selling, we have no substitutes. Like electricity, again, would be a good example. I mean, again, you know, beyond a certain price. I mean, if the price of electricity went to $1,000 a kilowatt hour, then maybe we would resort to other measures than doing what we're doing. But for all practical purposes, electricity doesn't have a substitute. What is a monopoly market? A market in which monopoly firm operates. So this is the type market. There's a perfectly competitive type market. There's a monopoly type market. Now, what makes a monopoly type market a monopoly? Well, there are always barriers to entry. This is one of the key characteristics of a monopoly. When we talk about perfect competition, how much land did we need to become tomato farmers?
1 square foot.
Yeah, maybe 1 square foot. It was easy to grow one tomato plant. We could a seed would grow a plant, and we'd get 6 or 8 and 10 tomatoes, and we'd take them to the side road, and we were tomato farmers. But in monopoly, it's almost impossible to enter into this type market. See, for perfect competition, we had easy entry. But for monopoly, we have a very difficult or even impossible entry, meaning that the barriers to entry for a monopoly are very high. Now, why they're high, there's different reasons, which we're going to talk about. But what is a barrier to entry? Here in slide 5, any impediment that prevents new firms from competing on an equal basis with existing firms in an industry is a barrier to entry. What are some examples of a barrier to entry? Legal restrictions, where the government might actually pass a law saying, we're going to give you monopoly status in this area. Economies of scale. Now, what's economies of scale? How would economies of scale be a reason for a barrier to entry? See, why is Walmart able to sell the same product as other companies but at a lower price? You're huge, see? That's economies of scale. See, Walmart is so big that they can buy in large quantities, and if you buy in large enough quantities, it's possible that you can get
a discount
on a per unit basis, right? See, as a company grows in size, there are many reasons that would enable that company to be more efficient. Better use of byproducts may be a reason. Buying in bulk, like we just talked about with Walmart, may be a reason. Having more ways to divide up the labor. So we can specialize in more ways, which we've learned can increase productivity. With size, maybe we can use machines that would not be practical if we were smaller. Like take a tractor, for example. Would a brand new, modern, $200,000 tractor be more efficient as an old 1955 tractor?
Is it more efficient than the new one? Yes.
Yeah, the new one will be more efficient, right? It'll be bigger, quicker, less fuel, could do more things, and be much more efficient. Now, if you were a farmer, let's say, but your farm is only 5 acres, would it benefit you to buy these very, very, very expensive tractors?
The old one.
even though it's more even though it's more efficient.
If the cheaper one can do the job, you're going to buy the cheaper one.
If it can just do the job.
If it can do the job.
But why not this great big one with air conditioning and can do all these fancy things? Because if you're small and you've got to spend all $200,000 for a tractor, it may not be cost efficient, right? See, you're not able to generate enough income on this small 5 acres to justify this large expenditure on this very expensive tractor. Now, if you're a very large farmer, where you might have a 1,000 acres, so you're dealing in large volumes, would it maybe be cost efficient to buy one of these more expensive but efficient tractors? Sure. Yeah, but just a job quicker. And so that's what we're saying here. See, we're saying that with economies of scale, well, maybe you can utilize machines that are more efficient, but if you were smaller, you couldn't justify that. So this is now economies of scale, by the way. What's the difference between the term economies of scale and the law of diminishing returns? Now, the economies of scale is a long-run term. The law of diminishing returns is a short-run term, although the concept is the same. See, in both cases, what we're saying is that if you grow in size, that you become more efficient, but if you keep on growing beyond a certain point, then you become actually less efficient. Now, that's what the law of diminishing returns says, but that's a short-run term where we cannot change our plant capacity. Now, if we're talking about economies and diseconomies of scale, that's a long-run term where we can change our capacity. But what we've got with these two terms is we've got a term that says economies of scale, and we've got another term that says diseconomies of scale. Economies of scale says as we grow, we become more efficient. Diseconomies of scale says we've gone beyond that point, and beyond that a certain point as we continue to grow, then we become less efficient. It's like a city. When you have a small town that starts to grow in size from a small town to a city, there are many reasons that will enable that city to become more efficient, that would experience economies of scale. Now, again, it's a long-run term, so we're allowing change to take place, right? Even change in terms of capacity. So as the small town becomes larger and larger, well, as more people come in, as tax base increases, it can build better roads, which will lead to more efficiency. There's lots of things that this city can do to become more efficient as it grows in size. Companies move in that may be feeder companies for one another, and so you cut down on transportation costs, and a lot of things are possible as the city grows. But if the city grows beyond a certain point, what happens? Well, then things become congested, and that may lead to diseconomies. You might have such a large infrastructure, your roads start to maybe getting old, and the cost of maintaining your infrastructure may increase. Crime might increase along with the size. Even the cost of just disposing garbage may become a monumental task as the city grows, and it's not so easy just to go on the outskirts of the city to dispose of your garbage. See, the point I'm making is that if we grow beyond a certain point, even in the long run, then we become less and less efficient. But in this case, what we're saying is that if you've got a business that's established and it's already experiencing economies of scale, it's very difficult for other new businesses to enter into that industry where they are unable to enjoy the same economies of scale as a big business. And therefore, how can they get a foothold in this market? Well, it may be impossible. That's what we're saying here. And a third reason for large barrier to entry or high barrier to entry is what we call control of essential resources. Now, with the control of central resources, maybe as a company grew and grew and grew, it bought up a certain resource whereby it was almost impossible for other companies to enter in to compete because it could not avail itself to those resources. Like there's a company in Canada called the Canadian Nickel Company that owns a vast majority of the world's known resources in nickel. Well, if you're a nickel company and you already own most of the world's resources in nickel, it's pretty hard for other companies to enter in to compete with you. This is slide 7. Can a monopoly make an economic profit in the long run? Now, what was the case in perfect competition? In perfect competition, why was it not possible to make an economic profit in the long run? See, what kind of profit did we... Where was the equilibrium? What kind of profit were we tending toward in the long run? The long run equilibrium was where the firm made a normal profit. In other words, why was it not possible to make an economic profit in the long run? The characteristic is the easy entry, easy exit. You see, in perfect competition, when a firm was making an economic, when the firms, plural, was when they were making an economic profit, what would happen?
More people would come.
Yeah, more firms would enter into that industry to partake in those economic profits. Now, they could do that because why? Because of the characteristics. Easy entry, easy exit. Firms are making economic profit. Other firms said, hey, we want to partake in those profits. We'll enter into this industry. And as a result, what happened to the supply curve?
Shifts to the right.
Shifts to the right. What happened to the market price? No, so supply shifts to the right. What happens to the market price? Those goes down. And as the price went down, eventually, what happened to our economic profits? See, they were eliminated. In fact, supply would shift so far to the right that now maybe the average firm is making less than a normal profit. Now, if firms are making less than a normal profit, what will they do?
Close down.
And if they close down, what happens to our supply curve? No, supply curve, yeah. If they close down, supply curve, you're right, it goes to the left. And as the supply shifts to the left, what happens to the market price? Goes up. And so at what point are we tending toward a normal profit? See, if we're making more than a normal profit, which is an economic profit, more firms enter, supply shifts to the left, price goes down, eliminating the economic profit. And then as supply shifts to the right far enough, now some firms are making less than the normal profit. They say, well, let's close down. Supply shifts to the left, price goes up, restoring more profits, right? And pretty soon, if supply shifts to the left far enough, well, now maybe firms are making an economic profit. So what happens? More firms enter in, and so, see, price goes up, price goes down. We're making more than a normal profit or an economic profit, and then other times we're making less than a normal profit. And so what point are we tending toward? Normal profit. Now, that's in perfect competition. But now, in a monopoly, can we make an economic profit even in the long run? If it's making an economic profit, are other firms going to say, hey, you guys are making economic profit, we're going to enter into this industry to partake in these profits? I mean, is that going to happen when you've got a monopoly situation? See, no. Why? Because of high barriers to entry. See, the barriers to entry are so high for a monopoly that it's possible for that monopoly to make an economic profit year after year after year and it not have to worry about added competition because of the high barriers to entry. That's a big, big difference between perfect competition and monopoly. Can a monopoly make an economic profit in the long run? This is slide 7. Yes, because of these barriers to entry that we just talked about. What is a patent? Patent is a legal barrier to entry that conveys its holders the exclusive right to supply a product for, well, I say 20 years here, but really a patent would depend on the type market that you're in. Some patents might run for 16 years, some might run for 20. Some might run for a shorter time. I mean, it's. But what's this patent all about anyway? I mean, what is a patent? What does a patent allow a business owner to do?
To sell his product.
Yeah, exclusive. Yeah, no one else. In other words, if you come up with an invention, let's say, and this invention gives you an edge in the market, but you get a patent on this invention. Then the government says, well, now you can market this product and no one can copy this invention you've got for at least X number of years. I thought that the consumer would benefit if we had more competition. I mean, we learned that you know, a free market system, we've got firms that are quick on their feet and are sensitive to consumers' wants will provide things that consumers want at reasonable prices, and that we should let the winners win and the losers lose, and the consumer benefits from all this by way of lower prices and higher quality products and businesses having to be sensitive to the consumers' wants and desires. So what's the thing about a patent? I mean, why should the government say, "Oh, we're go ahead and operate in this industry, and don't you worry because we're not going to allow anyone to compete with you"? Now, why do we do that? See, let's say that you were an inventor, and you've got either money yourself, or you've got usually backing of certain businessmen, so you spend, let's say, 10 years. Developing a product, and of course you spend millions of dollars, and
you have no incentive.
Yes, incentive is the key. Okay, let's say you spend 10 years and $10 million developing this new product, and you come out with it, and it's very popular, and you start making a whole bunch of money, and others say, "Hey, that's a great invention there. I think we'll copy it. We'll just buy one, figure out how you made it. We'll produce it. And we've actually got an advantage over you because we didn't have that 10 years development and all those development costs. We start off from base zero, so we're going to now compete with you." Well, if you knew that would happen beforehand, you wouldn't have spent those 10 years and those millions of dollars developing the product in the first place. So the whole point of patents is to encourage incentive, because you had exactly right, encourage incentive for people to invent and to come up with new processes and new inventions, which in the long run benefit everybody. Now, what is an innovation? An innovation is a process of turning an invention into a marketable product. See, there are inventions and there are innovations. An invention is a new tool or a new machine. An innovation is a new way of doing something. An innovation is something that's not physical. Innovation is a new process, maybe. So when does a firm experience economies of scale? When a firm increases resources in the long run and efficiency increases. This is what we're talking about here. See, we're saying that patents and all these things allow a company, as it grows, to experience economies of scale, which in turn is a barrier to entry, which enables it to be a monopoly. See, we're still talking about why firms evolve into a monopoly. And here's a picture of economies of scale as a barrier to entry. Long-run average cost curve is downward sloping, meaning that as we grow in size, our cost per unit go down. Now, what is a price searcher? A firm, this is slide 12, a firm that has some control over the price it charges because its demand curve slopes downward. See, what is the supply curve for a firm, now one, not the industry, but what did the supply curve for a firm as part of a perfect competitive market look like?
Slopes upward.
Downward. We're talking about demand, not supply. No, for perfect competition, it was
horizontal.
See, the demand curve for a firm, a single firm, part of perfect competition, was horizontal at the what?
Market
price. Now, how come it was horizontal at the market price? Because of the characteristic that firm could sell everything it brought to market at the market price, but if it charged a price higher than the market price, how many units would it sell? Nothing, because why should someone buy from them if they could buy from hundreds or thousands of others, same thing now, at a lower price? But is that true for a monopoly?
No.
No, it's not. See, for a monopoly, now you have a single seller. So really, the demand curve that a monopoly faces is the same as market demand because, well, they are the market. They're the only ones. But because they're the only ones, the demand curve is downward sloping. See, what did the demand curve for the whole industry look like in perfect competition?
Horizontal?
No. For the single firm, it was horizontal, but for the industry, it was downward sloping. Like if you take the demand curve for potatoes, well, as the price of potatoes goes up, you know, plural, if the price of potatoes goes up, what will people do?
They don't want to buy
substitutes. They won't buy substitutes. They won't buy as much. And if the price goes down, they'll tend to buy more. So the demand curve for the whole industry, see, the market was downward sloping. But in monopoly, well, you've only got the one seller. So the demand curve is downward sloping because of substitutes. I mean, you know, beyond if a monopoly charges a higher and higher price, what do people do? They'll buy less and less and less. They'll cut back. Even in things of that are necessities, a firm will at least can cut. I mean, a business or even an individual can cut back, right? I mean, if the price of electricity goes up, then people will turn down the thermostat. I mean, they'll still heat their homes, but they won't be quite as warm as before. Maybe, see, people will cut back, and the price goes down, and then there's a tendency for the quantity demand to go up. So this is what makes a monopoly a price searcher. See. In perfect competition, the firm was a price taker because they had to take whatever the market price was. But in monopoly, this firm is a price searcher because there's only one price, one unique price that a monopoly can charge whereby they'll maximize their profit or minimize their losses. So the question for a monopoly is what price are we going to charge to maximize the profit or minimize the loss? See, we didn't have to ask that in perfect competition. We didn't have to ask what price we're going to charge because in perfect competition, we just charge the market price. But for a monopoly, if we charge more than a certain price or less than that price, we'll make less money than if we charge that one unique price. So instead of having, see, for perfect competition, we only had one question. That was, well, how many units are we going to produce to maximize our profit? But for monopoly, we've got two questions. Not only how many units are we going to produce to maximize our profit, but what price are we going to charge as well in order to maximize our profit? What is that one unique price and that one unique quantity whereby we'll maximize our profit or minimize our losses? Now, see, I'm always talking about minimizing losses because even for a monopoly, why would a firm continue to operate even though it's making a loss?
The long run?
Well, yeah, the time frame. Because what time frame is all this analysis assume?
Short run.
So when we get into price output determination, we're talking about the short run. What is a single price monopoly? A monopoly firm that is limited to charging the same price for each unit of output sold. And for a single price monopoly, once a monopolist decides what price it's going to charge, then it charges the same price on all units. Now, what is a monopolist demand curve? It's the same thing as the market demand. I've already talked about this. Because it is the market, right? You only have the one firm.
Only option,
exactly. How is the demand curve derived for the single price monopoly? It's average revenue curve. D equals AR. AR stands for average revenue. I mean, what is a demand curve? What's the definition of a demand curve?
The measure of how much of something is demanded.
Well, okay, how much? How many units will be, you're exactly right, how many units will be demanded at various prices. You know, see, if the price go, see what we've got here, and this is what this diagram in slide 16 shows. If P is the price, then how many units are we going to produce? Well, you go across to hit your demand curve, because the demand determines how many units, right? And you go down to the horizontal axis, and wherever you come out, that's Q. Now, if the price goes down, what happens to Q? Yeah, it goes up, right? So you go across, hit your demand curve, and you come down, and you've got a higher Q. And as the price goes up, of course, if you go across your demand curve and come down, you get a lower Q, right? So, but here's the point. The point is that if a monopolist is going to charge the same price for all units, then as we take our total revenue and divide by Q, by quantity, what are we always going to get back to? Well, that is average revenue. If we take our total revenue and divide by quantity, then by definition, that gives us average revenue. But in this case, why does average revenue equal price? Average revenue equals price because we sold all our units for the same price. You see, we had to decide what price to charge, right, to maximize our profit. But once we decided what price to charge, what did we do?
Kept it the same.
Yeah, we charged the same price for all units. Now, if you sell all your units for the same price, and see, that's why we're talking, see, what we're talking about here is a single price monopolist. We're saying that, all right, we have a monopolist here that once they decide what price to charge, then they're going to charge the same price to everybody.
So it's part of the competition?
No, still a monopoly. It's just we just decide what price we're going to charge and then charge the same price to all our customers. See, it's called a single. See, you might have a monopolist that is not a single price monopolist. Like an example might be maybe there's a doctor in town, and this town is long ways away from a city, and maybe in the nearest city is 500 miles away, and so we're saying that doctor, for all practical purposes, would be a monopoly in that town. Maybe that doctor would become what is called a discriminating monopolist, meaning the guy that owns the mill in town that's providing all the jobs, or the real estate guy that owns almost all the land and all the buildings, they've got lots of money, and they come in and they get a broken arm, and maybe the doctor says, well, I'm going to charge you maybe $700. But then, a poor person comes in, has hardly got any money, and the doctor says, well, and they come in with a broken arm, And, you know, same thing as a wealthy guy, but the doctor says, well, I'm only going to charge you maybe $100. Yeah, see, that's what's called a discriminating monopolist. That he'll charge different prices to people depending upon, you know, a wide range of factors. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is the single price monopolist. We're saying, okay, now we've got a monopolist that now there's only one unique price that monopolist can charge to maximize the profit, right, or minimize the losses. But once it decides that price, it's going to charge the same price for all comers. And therefore, every time, if we take our total revenue and divide by quantity, we get average revenue, but that average revenue always equals what? Price. Yeah, the price. All right, so what we've got here is this a downward sloping demand curve, and this demand curve equals average revenue. Now, notice here that we have a marginal revenue curve that is underneath our demand curve and more steeply sloped. Now, what does the marginal revenue curve look like in perfect competition? It was horizontal at the market price. Now, in perfect competition, why did marginal revenue equal price for all units? Yeah, no matter how many units we sold, no matter how many, right? How much are we going to add to our total revenue? The price. And that price is the same, regardless of how many units. But is that true for a monopoly?
No.
No, it's not. For a monopoly, if a monopoly wants to sell more units, what does it have to do? It has to lower its price. Therefore, every time a monopolist lowers price, and that price applies to all units, not just the last unit, what is happening to marginal revenue each time? Marginal revenue goes down, you see. Marginal revenue becomes less and less and less. I mean, see, what is marginal revenue? Marginal revenue is what revenue did we make on the last unit, right? Well, if we want to sell more units, but in order to sell more units, we have to lower our price, then what happens? Well, marginal revenue is less than price for all but the first unit of output. Why? Because if we want to sell additional units, we had a lower price, and that price deduction applies to all units, not just the last unit. See, that's why marginal revenue is less than price for all but the first unit of output for a single price monopoly. And now what would that look like on a graph? Well, what it looks like on a graph is this, which we've got here in slide 16. We've got the downward sloping demand curve, which equals average revenue, but our marginal revenue curve is underneath our demand curve and more steeply sloped. For a monopoly, it is true that price equals average revenue. A monopoly, a price equals average revenue, but doesn't equal marginal revenue. Marginal revenue is less than price. Because of the fact
of the last unit, all units.
You know, in order to sell one additional unit, we have to lower our price
on all units,
and right. That's why margin revenue is less than price. What does those terms elasticity mean? All right, elastic means it can vary. Now, well, how does that compare to inelastic? I mean, what? We're talking about price here. Maybe the tuition that you pay to New River is pretty much inelastic, at least within a certain price range. Because if we talk about elasticity, normally we're talking about within certain price ranges. If I said that the price elasticity of demand for New River is relatively inelastic, what would that mean? Well, what that mean is that if we change price, what's that going to do to the number of students that will come to New River? If tuition faces a relatively inelastic demand curve, that means that we can raise tuition, but
demand stays
That, yeah, or at least it's not going to be affected very much.
Very much.
I mean, we could raise tuition, let's say 10%, and maybe only a few students would say, oh, I don't want to pay that 10% higher price. But only a few. Now, if the tuition at NRCC faced a very elastic demand curve, what that would mean is that if we increased tuition just a little bit, what would happen to the quantity demand? I mean, what would happen to the number of students that say, hey, I want to come to New River for an education? It would be affected a lot. You see, elastic means a big change. Inelastic means a little change. Well, what this graph is showing us is that at higher prices, demand tends to be more elastic, and at lower prices, demand tends to be more inelastic. And that's true because a percent change at higher prices translates into a higher money volume, you know, a higher money amount than that same price percent change for lower priced a situation. Like, if you're talking about, the price of a new car and the price of a new car is, let's say, $30,000, well, a 10% change in price is $3,000, right? And that $3,000 may have a big effect on whether you buy the car or not. How about a 10% change in price of a box of salt that maybe started out at 40 cents a box? I mean, what's 10%
of 40 cents?
10% of 40 cents? Yeah, 4 cents, right? Now, would a 4 cent change in the price of a box of salt make a big difference on how many people bought the salt? No. I mean, how many people are even going to notice a 4 cent change? See, so at this lower price, demand tends to be more inelastic. I mean, it doesn't, a change in price isn't going to affect the quantity demanded, but at least not very much. But at higher prices, that same percentage change in price may have a big effect. And that is why, with the demand curve, if you're talking about the upper portions, you're talking about the demand curve being more elastic, and at lower prices, the demand curve is more inelastic.
Thank you.
Now, unit elastic, what does unit elastic mean?
Equilibrium.
Yeah, but what is that? That means that if we, remember, when we change price, we win in one way and lose another way, right? Like if we raise price, well, we gain because we're making more money per unit, but we lose because we're selling fewer units. So what elasticity really is a measure of which effect it overpowers the other. But when something is unilastic, that means that, for example, we could raise price and we would lose the same amount of money that we would gain. In other words, if we raise price, we're going to sell fewer units. And let's say we lose $1,000. But we gain $1,000 because we're making more money for every unit we sell. So the amount of money we gain equals the amount of money we lose when we change price. And that's what's called unit elastic. See, it's neither inelastic nor inelastic. This is slide 17, and what this shows us, what happens to, this is a monopoly demand, loss and gain in total revenue from selling one more unit. See, because of this difference in elasticity at the lower ranges, we can increase our price and our total revenue will increase, but beyond a certain point, then as we increase price, our total revenue will actually go down. Because now remember, we are talking here about a single price monopolist. So what is a natural monopoly? We're still talking about the characteristics here of monopoly, and there are different types of monopolies. A natural monopoly, this is slide 18, due to economies of scale, one firm can operate at lower average costs than can two or more firms. See, why is it that if we want to purchase cable television, we can only buy from one firm? Or if we want to buy electricity, we can only buy from one firm? Well, the reason is that, there's really lots of reasons, but why would a government come in and they say to a utility company, if you do your thing, you can sell energy in this geographic location and we're going to make it so that no one can compete with you. I mean, we're going to have a law here saying that you've got the legal right to sell and no one can compete with you. Now, why would we do that? I mean, how does society gain from that? Well, society gains from that because for lots of reasons. First of all, if you consider a free market, it costs a lot of money to come in, build, power stations, generators, run miles of wire, poles, hire workers. It's a lot of money and a lot of time involved before we've got our system in place whereby we can start making a profit. Now, if we thought that by going into this an area here, if we could spend all this time and money, but there may be other firms that can come in and compete with us, and we're really not sure how much of the market we'll have compared to how much market they will have, well, there's too much uncertainty here. I mean, there are other places that we can put our money as investors where there are lower risks.
Right.
Maybe the return may not be quite higher, but the risk is so much lower, and we just don't want to take these high risks with this energy business. But if the government comes and says, look, if you will do this, if you will make this investment, you won't have any competitors, then that lowers the risk factor, correct? Which encourages more investment. Socially, it's more desirable because if one company can provide an area with power, let's say, using one set of wires, then why should we have 10 companies with 10 different sets of wires providing the same thing? I mean, that's just it messes up our environment, right? Our skyline is now nothing but wires. I mean, it's a non-necessary duplication of our scarce resources. It may cause more pollution. So, you see, socially, it's better for us to have one company to do it all rather than several companies. Now, of course, you all know that whatever the government gives on one hand, they take away with the other, right? So the government would say, well, you come in, make this investment, we're going to make sure that no one can compete with you. So what do we take away?
Their ability to increase their price passes.
Yeah, price. We take away their ability to dictate the price. Right, so we have to approve. A government agency now has to approve what price they're going to charge, so that they cannot take unreasonable advantage of the consumer because of their monopoly status. Now, here's the key question. Let's say that you represented a government agency that determined what price this monopoly is going to charge. Now, what price would you want that monopoly to charge? Or what kind of profit would you want that monopoly to make? You represent this government agency, and you have to have some guideline to say, well, this is a reasonable price, but this is not a reasonable price. I mean, up to this price it's reasonable, but above this price it's not reasonable. Well, what's going to tell you if a price is reasonable or not?
Demand.
But what kind of profit would you want that monopolist to make?
Normal profit.
A normal profit, exactly. Your guideline is a normal prophet. You, because what is a normal profit? A normal profit is the minimum amount of money that a business owner can make and continue operating the business. So you want that monopoly to make enough money whereby they will have an incentive to do what they do, right? But not necessarily more than that. So you're so if you were on this board and it was up to you to decide what price this monopoly can charge, your guideline is going to be, well, now, what price would exist if this firm were making a normal profit? And then that's the price that we're going to say, you can charge this price. So if we raise price and our total revenue goes up, we call that inelastic. If we raise price and our total revenue goes down, then we call that elastic. And the reason why elasticity, I mean, it's a factor here with a monopoly, because what we're talking about is high prices versus low prices, and we've got this demand curve, and you know, and so there's a difference of elasticity along this demand curve from high price to low price. Okay, so how does the government foster monopolies, patents, trademarks, copyrights? Exclusive government franchises, like you know, the power company or the cable company. You know, all these are examples of the government fostering monopolies. And see, what we're saying here is that there are different reasons why we would want government to allow companies or even encourage companies to be monopolies. Okay, there are cases where that is desirable. Okay, what is the purpose of patents and copyrights? Okay, to give people and firms the incentive to invest their time and money into new products and creative works, which translates into a growing dynamic viable economy. What is a government franchise? A government granted right to be a sole seller of a product or service. Okay, that's just a term, government franchise. When does a government grant a franchise? When it thinks the market in question is a natural monopoly, like the power company or the cable company. What are some examples of government franchises? Because U.S. Postal Service, local telephone service. Now, when I'm talking about the U.S. Postal Service, I mean, what has happened as time goes on? See, markets change. I mean, see, when you're talking about a monopoly, you're always talking about competition.
Billion.
Yeah, yeah. See, what I mean, one competition for the Postal Service is online banking. Yeah, and paying. I mean, I pay all my bills online. I don't mail. The Postal Service becomes less and less of a monopoly, right? I mean, because it's got more competition. Then maybe not in other companies that mail letter, you know, that handle letters. So the Postal Service may not be the best example of a government franchise here because of changes in markets. Same with local telephone service, right? Local telephone service. I mean, in one sense, it's a monopoly, but what's happened to competition with local telephone service? Well, now, I mean, the computer, with cell phones and Skype, in Skype, you can call anyone anywhere in the world and talk all day long. It doesn't cost a dime. So, so that market's definitely changed. Now, electric, gas, water, utilities, garbage collection, even cable TV, well, at least garbage collection, you know, those are definitely monopolies. Cable TV, again, in one sense, this is a monopoly, but then, too, there's so much more, because the Internet especially, right, and satellite, that there's, you know, more options. I mean, not in terms of cable TV, but satellite and Internet, and, you know, you watch movies. I mean, I watch movies on the Internet all the time. Is a government franchise a win-win deal for the protect company? No. Most often, the government regulates its prices and profits. What is the government's objective for the monopoly? To make a normal profit. See, that's our guideline. Now, why is MR less than P for all but the first unit of output for a single price monopoly? Well, now this takes us into this price output determination. So what we've done up to this point is that we've simply talked about the characteristics of a monopoly. What makes a monopoly a monopoly, and how does a monopoly differ from other markets, like perfect competition? But now what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, now that we know what a monopoly is, if we were a monopoly, how would we make this decision of what price to charge and what quantity to produce to maximize the profit or minimize the losses? And if we're making a profit, what will our profits be at our point of profit maximization? If we're making a loss, what will our losses be at this point of loss minimization? And if we're making a loss, should we stay open or close down? Now, that's what we're going to look at next time.